ahead and get started. Thank you to all of you who are here this morning. It's great to see such a large group. I'm really excited to talk with all of you. So if you have not met me yet, my name is Allison Gray, and my day job is teaching at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, in the areas of New Testament and early Christianity. So I am here with you this week to do the Living Word Bible study, thinking about the way that metaphors are used in the New Testament to create community. And one of the things I want to play with in our conversation is what these metaphors meant in the context where early Christian authors were using them. What was their social context, and what did these metaphors mean? How were they useful? And then what do those metaphors mean to us today? There's a lot of overlap, but there are also some gaps in the cultural baggage and cultural awareness that we bring to the metaphors. And so I think it's worth examining the way that those metaphors have changed for us and where they're useful for building community and where they might create blockages to community participation. So the plan for the session, like what the other things we've been doing this week, is to maybe not. Advance manually. To look a little bit at the first century context and to think about how today the metaphor of athlete or athletic training gets used to create kinship and belonging within the early Christian community. And then move to talk about our context and a few case studies from the contemporary world that I think shed light on our own expectations of what it means to be an athlete. And then save time for a conversation about how that metaphor of being an athlete in the household of God, being an athlete running the race for salvation, might be useful to us today, where we might see some problems or perils if we use that metaphor. So let's start with a text. This is from 2 Timothy. This is a second generation Pauline writing, probably not by Paul. Most biblical scholars agree that this is a later author who is claiming the authority of Paul, standing in line of Pauline tradition, but writing as though he is Paul to Paul's associate, Timothy. So there's a lot of similarities between language that gets used in these pastoral letters, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, and the seven letters that we know to have been written by Paul. So here the author says, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. From now on there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing." So if we just look at this passage, what does it mean to be an athlete? What is the athletic contest that people are engaging in? What is the goal?
Fight.
A fight. Okay, do you want to say a little bit more?
Boxing, I presume.
Okay.
Wrestling.
Yes.
I'm wrestling in those days, maybe.
Sure.
A runner.
No. Running, yes. No. Right, there's this literal background that he's thinking with, right? There's a fight, there's a race. I fought, I have finished the race. And then he throws in this phrase, "I have kept the faith." So what's the link there? Or what is he trying to say about what it means to keep the faith?
Well, the struggle puts it at risk. I mean, the struggle may put it at risk, the faith.
So the faith itself might not be able to sustain because of the struggles that one faces?
In the course of running the race.
Okay.
And implication is he didn't give up. He continued the fight or the race.
And there might be competition.
Yeah, what kinds of competition might we imagine? So you've suggested that it might be struggles that you face in life might bring a threat to your persevering in faith. But what else might be competition or blockages?
Other thoughts, other interpretations.
Okay.
What it means to lead the faithful life.
Right, what is the definition of keeping the faith? Through hardship or with competing options for definitions of salvation? Right? Other thoughts?
Actual persecution.
Sorry?
In these generations, actual persecution.
Yes, absolutely.
I was going to say, fought the good fight. Maybe keeping the faith is playing by the rules. The good fight.
right? What does it mean to fight the good fight? So maybe that means you're doing it in the proper way.
Doing it the right way, with the right attitude.
Good. So it might not just be about following the rules. It might be about the sort of internal approach that you take to engaging in that fight.
Other gods, like the other belief systems, would be keeping the faith. I'm using the same words over and over again. But
no, excellent. But if we think about the audience that Paul is writing to, the book of Acts and Paul's own letters tell us specifically that he is the apostle to the Gentiles, right? So he is talking to those who are not part of a monotheistic faith, who may not have the background understanding what it means to be in a covenant relationship with the one God of Israel. And so they might believe in other gods or other rituals. And so keeping the faith means staying on a single track. Okay. What about this crown of righteousness?
Yes.
Does one person
get it? Yeah. Is that like the laurel wreath?
Yes, so this is the athletic, the winner of the athletic contest.
Be like, oh, lucky fall.
Ah, okay, so here is one aspect of the athletic metaphor that might be slightly troubling to us. The idea that there is one winner.
But then it contradicts it in the last line.
Right, exactly.
I guess there's lots of crowns.
There appear to be lots of crowns, right? There will be a crown not just for me, but also for all who have longed for the Lord's appearing.
Good 1960s Catholic doctrine was we had a crown in heaven, and good works, you know, improved that crown.
And that also seems to be here, right? If you hold on through what goes on earth, if you endure through whatever persecution you're facing and you keep the faith, there is a crown that's going to be present for you on that day. When Paul talks about that day, he's referring to the parousia, or the second coming of Christ. So he's really talking about the Lord's day from Hebrew Bible prophetic tradition, and that day of judgment. Right? And here is God as judge. So what does it mean to be an athlete in a race where God is the judge?
Scary.
Tell me why. You're not wrong. What's scary about that?
Scary.
I don't know. It says that it doesn't say you have to win. You just have to want to win. Just long for...
He tried his best. I fought the good fight.
Mm-hmm. He finished the race. It doesn't say that he came in first.
No.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Faithful.
Yes, keeping the faith, and then the ones who are longing for his appearing.
The past tense is really interesting to me.
Say why.
Because both the Augsburg Confession and the Council of Trent condemn people as Pelagians who claim that they know that they have been saved.
Mm-hmm.
He's in this, look at verse 8, right? From now on, there is reserved for me. He knows it's coming.
Wow.
So
he's a heretic.
Okay. So you've just been accused of being a heretic as someone says, so do I. Why do you know it's coming?
Because he died and rose for me.
Right, so Paul is looking at this future that has not yet happened in light of the events that have happened, which is the saving death and resurrection of Christ. Right, so he is confident, maybe in a way that later we say, oh, that seems a little troubling that you could be so confident. How do you know? Right, but he is looking forward, fully confident in the events that have happened that have set him on this path. And he says, if I just stay on this path, this is what is going to happen.
Because Jesus came for the world, and the righteous judge and the crown of righteousness, I mean, I feel like in some ways, we've dialogued about this, it's almost like a scary thing, but if we have been made righteous through Jesus Christ, so our righteous judge is a loving judge and a gracious and a forgiving judge, you know, like righteousness doesn't need to have this negative connotation. Uh-huh. Righteousness can be beautiful and redeemed and saved.
Right, so this is, God is the judge who's going to grant the crown, right? The crown is reserved for him, but God is the one who decides that he gets that crown.
Okay.
have a teacher who's saying about righteousness is, it's God's fierce determination to make all things right.
So God himself, with this athletic metaphor, is engaged in the struggle in some way, right? One of the things that's really interesting to me is that there appear to be rules, and if you follow the rules, there is an expected outcome. And for people of faith, that is both reassuring, and I find that a little scary.
Right?
If there are rules, and I'm supposed to figure out what the rules are, and I'm supposed to follow them properly in order to earn the crown, how do I do that?
Well, I think Paul's talking about the assurance of faith, too. Is because, I mean, once we accept Christ, we're assured of salvation. There's no question that we're going to lose our salvation.
Depends on which tradition you're from, including the Lutheran tradition, which wants to say you can lose your faith. Martin Luther says, for example, in the when he's talking to Thomas, that Christ imprisons sin within you, but you are always capable of letting that sin back out again.
And I think that's Paul's language of perseverance, right?
Yeah,
that you have to
yeah.
stick with it, and if you stick with it.
That's the encouragement to do that. When I saw your outline, I had a couple of thoughts. One is that they would use soldiers and athletes as examples of the faith, but I think that Christian and Jewish culture at the time kind of found both repugnant. The early church kind of frowned on being a soldier, maybe not universally, but it was there. And athletes did their athletic stuff in the naked, which was repugnant.
Not to everyone, yeah. So let's talk about what people thought about athletes. Well, yeah, speak for myself. But this is great, because what were attitudes towards athletes in the ancient world? And I think they were mixed.
Yes.
Early Christ believers, because they came from both a Jewish background and a Gentile background, had sort of mixed views of athletes. And early Christianity does some really fascinating stuff with the athletic image.
Right.
So let's look at some pieces from the ancient world to sort of get at that question. Paul's image seems to be positive, but let's think about how that works. So here are your nude athletes in the ancient world on a Greek vase. This is an image of the pentathlon, which would have been five athletic events. And you can see that these are both adult and young men. So the young man in the back appears not to have a beard. And so that's showing that he's clean shaven shows that he is younger than the others here. But you see that they are nude, they are well muscled, they are active and in this very dynamic pose. This is the image of athletes from the classical world, maybe 5th century Athens, where we've got the Olympics going on. Every young man receives athletic training at the gymnasium. And it's not just about training the body, right? There is a key term that gets used in ancient athletics called ascesis, which is the root of our English word ascetic. So here's the Greek. So what does it mean to be an ascetic or to practice asceticism?
Forgo, abstain, deny.
Forgo, abstain, deny. The root of it is really about discipline. And so you can discipline and train your body by denying it creature comforts, right? That's the sort of take that we have today. And athletes were actively involved in ascesis.
No drinking or smoking during football.
You are to discipline the body in order to get it into its best possible shape. There is the celebration of the human body and its form and its skill. And athletes are sort of the pinnacle of that. And so there were celebrations of athletic prowess. If you read even all the way back in Homer from the 8th century BCE, the way that you celebrate a funeral is to have games at the same time where people demonstrate physical health and strength in the face of death and loss. So athleticism was really a focal point for classical Greek society. And it's really interesting to think about the way philosophers talked about athletes. Because what they're doing with their bodies is also really important for their souls. So this is a funny image from the movie 300. I hope many of you have seen this sort of ridiculous story about the Spartan stand, where 300 Spartans held ground against Persian forces. But the athlete, especially if he used his athletic skill for soldiering, was an important part of the city-state. So you were training people to do archery, running, throwing a discus, but it was about that self-discipline. It was about the virtues of the soul that were gained through physical practice of self-denial, of daily discipline. And that made you a good citizen. So if you were an athlete and you're competing for that crown, it's not just about being the best at boxing or running the fastest. It's that demonstration that you can run the fastest actually proves that you have cultivated the right quality of soul to practice, right? That you are persevering. So Paul's link between the athlete and perseverance or endurance is a fairly natural one for the ancient world. And there are a lot of dialogues from philosophers where someone from a foreign land will come to Greece and say, why are your young men spending the whole day running around in the nude and wrestling in the dirt? And the philosopher will say it's because it makes them good men. Okay. So athletes were seen positively in the classical world. Once the Roman Empire comes around, this is not like a stark one day it's one thing, the next day it's something else. But there is a transition to athletes becoming show people, showmen, really. But there were female gladiators. So these are gladiators, and you can see that they have fairly elaborate costumes, and there were different types, and each type of gladiator would have a traditional set of weapons and kind of armor, and they would sort of face off in traditional pairings. You would have the guy with the net facing against somebody with a spear so that you could see if the net can capture the spear before you can stab him, right? So they would have these shows. Like the games that happened at Greek funerals, there would be these feats of athletic prowess in Greek and Roman cities in the arena for people to enjoy. Contrary to popular belief, gladiators were not normally going to die at the end of the show, right? We have this image of somebody putting the thumbs down and then the gladiator gets killed. That's actually not very common because these athletes received a huge investment of time and money in their training. And so they became quite famous. There are known gladiators and athletes who have speeches written about them, whose images are preserved in painting, in poem, in mosaics like this. They were celebrities in the ancient world.
There were female gladiators?
There were some female gladiators that we know about.
Were there female athletes?
Not as many female athletes, no. Not for the running and archery. But for the gladiators, yes.
Is that the victim in the white robe?
That's probably a servant who is helping them to dress for combat. And by servant, I mean slave. But they're getting prepared. You can see one battle going on and others who are sort of getting equipped to head out into the arena. So by the time we have gladiator shows, yes, question.
Yeah, my question is, so were you chosen to be an athlete or chosen to be gladiator? I mean, was that kind of like an honorable thing? I mean, I have to believe that brothers and sisters, not everyone was chosen to be the athlete downtown. You know what I mean? So there were people who were left out of all this elitism as well, right?
That's a great question. So this is a transition that I did not mention, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Athletes in the Greek world, most young men in a city-state would train as athletes, and then many would go into military service with that athletic training. In the Roman world, gladiators were often drawn from the lower classes or from slaves. So there was this transition to see athletes as a form of entertainment or spectacle that you could observe. So you would observe the athletic prowess, but you would be an elite member of society watching the lower classes of society perform for your entertainment. So to be a gladiator was both a way to distinguish yourself and to become famous, but you were not from the upper echelons of society, and this is where we get the sort of looking down upon athletes as a lower class or as people who were not respectable. And because athletes used their bodies and trained their bodies in this way, and their bodies were on display, there was a lot of association in elite society between athletes and prostitution. Athletes and actors and musicians were all seen as those whose bodies were available for money. And so it was not a respectable position to hold. So it's interesting to think about the way Paul is using this image to say that you're an athlete. Is he trying to play on the idea of the ancient Greek athlete who learns virtue, or is he playing on the spectacle celebrity athlete?
Well, since he's writing to a Greek audience, my preference would be he's using the Greek.
And that image has not gone away, right? So he is writing in to a Greek audience, but those are Greek city-states that are now part of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them have been colonized by the empire, and in the first century would identify as traditionally Greek, but with Roman status of some kind. So this metaphor may be a little bit mixed, and it's worth thinking about both the positive and negative sides of what it means to be an athlete in his world. Early Christians do some really interesting stuff with athleticism and the idea of ascesis and training and discipline. So this is a wonderful image of Ignatius of Antioch. Christians were not actually thrown to the lions all that often, but sometimes they were, and this is what Ignatius expected. And you can see some people looking on as he is attacked by lions, and his attitude towards this was that his death was going to be a sign of his endurance. And this is what we mean by the word martyr. A martyr is one who is a witness or gives testimony with their very life that they have held on to the faith. So early Christians picked up on Paul's image of the athlete who endures to the end, who engages in the contest, who holds on to that discipline and their faith. And so martyrs were seen as people who were appropriately disciplined to endure. We also have female martyrs. This is a very famous Perpetua, who had a dream that she was going to be martyred, right? She was in prison. She insisted that she ought to die. She had a child in prison, gave up the child so that she could wean the child more quickly because she was ready to die for her faith. She sort of said, I am ready to be a martyr. Because I am a Christian, I'm going to die. My child can go be with my family. But she showed such courage and discipline that when the soldier was resisting killing her in the arena, she guided the sword into her own body because she was so sure about her endurance. So you can see one of the ways that this image of athletic prowess played out is in the lives of early Christian martyrs who said, I am the athlete with the virtue who can endure. I'm not sure that we carry that all the way forward today, but we still keep that idea of ascesis, right? Not many of us are martyrs, but that discipline has remained important for our Christian understanding of what it means to be part of a faith community. Let's look at another text. This is from one of the, what we would call, authentic Pauline epistles. So this is 1 Corinthians, where he writes, "Do you not know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it. Athletes exercise self-control," and that's the ascesis there, "in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath." Remember that these wreaths are made of laurel. "But we compete for an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air. But I punish my body and enslave it, so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified." So if we think about this as what Paul is advising for his Christian community members, what does he want them to do? What does it mean to be an athlete in this Christian community?
Be a good example.
Can you say a little bit more about that? I think you're absolutely right.
What did she say?
She said, be a good example. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, he's following the fitness rules so that he's strong and makes himself strong. Mm-hmm.
And I say he because I imagine it's a man.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that he's on the hot seat.
Yes, right? If you are going to claim that you have this discipline and skill, it's going to be put to the test. And you don't want to be kicked out of the contest for having broken the rules or for having displayed a lack of skill.
Render shaming.
Yes, and this is, we know that the ancient world is largely an honor shame based culture. So the public eye is on someone who is doing this kind of performance.
Right. If they would be following the early church of Acts, exercising this self-control and punish my body and enslave it. I mean, that could be even to the extent of, you know, sharing your stuff instead of caring for only your own family, or, you know, taking it one step further into, like, to live the way that the early church was living was countercultural, you know, and so having a monogamous relationship, or, you know, just like, I don't know, I just embracing the early church's practices was probably using that self-control in a way, kind of like what you were talking about being in the public eye. I mean, that would be counter to what the whole societal would be accepting.
Sure. Yeah. And that idea of self-control is really important for the Corinthian community, right, where there is discord. Some of the other things that Paul talks about are, make sure that you discipline yourself. You might know that the bread that's been sacrificed to idols or the food that's been sacrificed to idols doesn't have any problems with it, but if it's going to cause your brother to trip up, don't eat it, right? So exercise self-control for the benefit of the community. Yeah. Yes.
The gut response of mine is, I much prefer Timothy at my age with this body, because I fought the fight. This one makes me feel like, man, you better still be fighting hard.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, and Timothy seemed more inclusive.
So talk to me about that, right? In what ways is this exclusive? So it might be...
Okay, I couldn't hear her.
Yeah, so the Timothy letter appears to be more inclusive, right? And this seems maybe a little more stringent. And so who might be excluded if we use this metaphor? Those who are not fully able-bodied, right? Yes. I would say that's all of us at any given time, but for some more than others, right? Yeah.
I think we're mixing metaphors. that the enslavement or the punishing and so forth and so on has to do with following the words of Jesus or doing what was taught, mm-hmm. not dancing or not drinking or that kind of thing. So what he's talking about here has to do with the fact that the Corinthians have gotten mixed messages about, well, a number of things, but I'm trying to think of what this word.
Oh, sexual morality is one thing that's going on in that community. How to engage with Jews and with other Gentiles, and what does it mean to have table fellowship?
You know, that some people, mm-hmm. that everybody has to be circumcised. So he's talking about this, you know, let's go back to knowing what the real world rule is, I guess you could say. We're not talking about extraneous things. We're talking about following Jesus.
Sure. And here's that rule or guideline idea again, right? I think this comes up a lot with athletes, that there is a right way, and then there are a lot of things you could do wrong that would mean you don't get the wreath. So in some ways, I think this image, going back to that idea of God as righteous judge, I agree that in the full context of what early Christian teaching says, that righteous judge is also merciful, right? But if we stick strictly with the athletic metaphor, that carries with it an idea of God is the one who can sort of point to you and say, you are disqualified, right? You have not met the standards. There are very stringent requirements here. Are there ways that this is true for Christian life, that there are strict and stringent requirements, or that there is a way to do it?
I just want to point out that we're all disqualified. None of us measure up.
Yeah. So in light of that, if all of us are disqualified, if none of us measure up, then how is this athletic metaphor useful?
Keep trying.
Okay. So it's the endurance aspect of it that might be most powerful for us?
And the discipline.
Okay.
I put the emphasis on in such a way that you keep the mission in mind, but that doesn't mean you're going to achieve it, I guess.
Right? There is a goal. That comes along with the athletic metaphor, too. If you're running the race, there's a place that you are meant to get to. There is a telos, or a finishing place. And so maybe it's about keeping that goal in mind, organizing your life around the goal, and disciplining yourself so that you might be ready, whether you can actually get there or not, right? There is something that you're aiming for.
That ties into verse 26. I don't run aimlessly or box as though I'm beating the air, but do things that will be effective for you.
Yes.
Like have a focus and have a goal and don't just be distracted and doing things needlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and don't give up.
Right. Yeah, I like this idea of efficiency too, right? That this is, if I'm going to compete and I'm going to discipline my body, I'm going to do it in a way that's directed at the right thing, not just for the sake of doing it, right?
And realistically, which is different at your different stages of life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when I teach this case to my students, the athletes immediately get it, right? Partly because they're used to putting themselves in the hands of somebody else to tell them what to do in mm-hmm. order to do these things. That you have a coach for a reason, so that you don't do exercises that don't help you, so that you're doing them correctly. I'm wondering if there's, in the midst of that, and maybe I hope I'm not jumping the gun here, but I'm wondering if there's a difference between their understanding of athletes and ours that gets in the way, in that we tend to think of athletes as a little bit stupid, whereas the Greeks tend to see as Caesar as leading to wisdom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, so I will take this question and sort of twist it a little bit. When we think about what are the virtues of an athlete today, what does it mean to be a good athlete today?
$1 million.
Right, so these are the marks that someone is a good athlete. It's not about the wreath. It's not about their virtue that they're displaying. It's more about the outward signs of wealth.
Scholarships.
Okay, scholarships. And that's really interesting, right? Because then it's, if you're a student athlete, there is some link between physical and intellectual training that's meant to be happening, maybe, right? So what's the gap here? What is it that we expect of athletes in today's culture?
Discipline.
So that piece is still there.
I think of a halfback, and I think mental sharpness, mental speed, and
for what purpose? What are they supposed to use that mental acuity for?
To lead the group.
Okay.
To win the prize. And right. To stay self-disciplined. To stay toward the goal.
Mm-hmm. So you think of the athletes on the team as those who are doing the mental work to figure out how to get the team towards the goal. Do other people agree?
No.
Where does that mental work and guidance come from? If we think about a football team.
Desire.
Well, practice. You have to practice.
Yes, practice.
Okay, so some of it becomes that discipline and practice. And then there is this emotional component. We think of athletes as being people who are really driven.
Driven.
Yeah. Yep. But
good athletes also think mm-hmm. and understand what the situation is and can react to it.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to work as a group.
The dump jump here.
Yeah.
They just have the body. They've been blessed with this body. They don't have necessarily the mind to go with the body, but they have the dumb jock, like they've got a great body, and so we're gonna put them on the team so they can, you know, hit the two, you know, do the dunks, and they can, you know, kick the goal or whatever. It's not necessarily that. I mean, I'll be honest, like when peers of mine would get scholarships to go wherever for basketball, I'm like, oh great, you're going for basketball, you know, like I never, and that's just I mean, I can judge myself. Like, I was closed-minded, but I was like, well, I had worked my tail off to get a scholarship, and it wasn't because I could play basketball, you know?
So I think there are two competing models in our contemporary culture, right? We have maybe the intellectual athlete who is highly skilled and driven and who understands the sport and can think about it and really get in and do that well, lead a team. And then we also have this model of somebody who is just a body, right?
It also depends on your position on the team.
Yes.
If you're the quarterback or the point guard, you're forced to be planning, strategizing more than a lineman whose job is to knock the other guy down.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, still needs to know the plays, but doesn't require the advanced, you know, circuitry, you know.
And we're seldom requiring athletes to be experts at multiple sports, right? That's actually pretty rare. If you have a professional athlete who plays multiple sports, those people are sort of held up as especially impressive because, and people who are in the Olympics, right, who are specialized at one very specific thing. Whereas in the ancient Greek world, there was sort of an expectation that if you were training as an athlete, you might have one sport you were better at, but you were supposed to be good at all of them, right?
Well, I was just thinking about Olympic athletes.
Yes.
Whether you're a skater or a dance, you know, ice skater or a gymnast or a, you know, speed skater, whatever, you've dedicated your entire life to that goal, almost to the exclusion of other things you maybe should be dedicated to. But that is a single-minded purpose.
Yes, I love that word single-mindedness, right? That's exactly what we expect of our athletes. Like, this is the thing that you have chosen to devote your life to, and that's what you should stick with.
And yeah. I think the idea of an athlete as a role model is something that's struggling right now.
Yes, so I want to, I'll go ahead and take your comment.
I'm pondering a lot of this stuff, and part of the win part just doesn't jive with my faith, because the win has already happened. And so I think, you know, through grace, you know, Martin Luther, you know, our faith, we won the race through grace. So I have two perspectives, that there's the athlete that is about the win. You know, you got to win it for the team or whatever. And then I keep thinking of, you know, whenever I'm working on whatever, it's for my personal best.
Yes.
And I think that's what my faith is I'm striving, that might be not good, but my faith is about my personal best, you know, whatever God wants, that's the journey that I'm going to take, is for the personal best, and for not just for me, but for those around me.
Yeah, thank you for this. It's one of the costs of using this metaphor, because when Paul says, you know that in a race, the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize. You have this competitive component to it that may not jive with the way we want to think about what it means to live in Christian community, right? This might get us to the single-minded nature of it. We ought to devote ourselves fully to our faith, so that's helpful for thinking about what we're all doing individually. But when we bring in our concept of contemporary athleticism, a lot of it is about team sports and competition. Right, and there is a winner and there is a loser. And even in the Olympics, we're seeing this beautiful display of the absolute top of human potential, but there's still a winner and there are losers, right? And so that aspect of the athletic competition metaphor might be problematic.
Yeah, I think running races tend to have more of there's obviously a winner, but there's a lot of emphasis.
Right, maybe you're doing it on time, right? So you're like, if I complete the race, maybe that was my goal, right? We might have differential goals. Paul here is sort of working with the goal is the crown, right? So you're absolutely right that there are some ways that this metaphor limits the ways we can think about working together because it's so focused on the individual's journey. Yes?
I tend to think of athletes in two different ways. Like the people that are in the Olympics, to me, are up here. The people who are getting paid $2 million while a teacher gets paid $25,000, there's not the same feeling for me.
What's the difference?
The money.
Okay, so maybe it's about what the reward is,
yeah,
right?
But it's all about money. I mean, the whole thing is about money. Even in the Olympics, they're sponsored by athletic Nike or some shoe company or some.
Do those athletes get that $1 million?
Well.
They get prizes from the United States for winning a gold medal. For
right.
Monetary
And the endorsement.
Yeah. I mean, this.
So there are some who don't get much.
No, but few and far between, I think.
I think there is a really interesting question here about when we think about what it means to be a good athlete, are we bringing into question people's motivations? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. I saw your hand.
I was wondering about the emergence of team sports. Mm-hmm. Because so often, it seems like with the ancient Romans and Greeks, we're focused on individual mm-hmm. athletes. And today, of course, we have baseball, football, soccer. And we need everyone to play, though we may have a few stars. Mm-hmm. And so when did team sports come into being? And that's a, I think, as a Christian community, mm-hmm. we're really a team
yep.
sport.
So here is something, I want to comment just on that last piece, that as Christians, we can think about ourselves as a team. That is something that we bring to the metaphor of being an athlete that people from the ancient world would not bring,
okay.
right? And so in some ways, this goes back to Anne. Is that Anne's idea? That it's if we think about the competition, that could be problematic. But if we bring our cultural context of team to this metaphor, it might help us.
Although, in terms of military, the athlete involved mm-hmm. in the military, mm-hmm. as they develop formations like phalanxes and mm-hmm. others, then it became a team sport.
Mm-hmm. One of the most funny examples that I just want to share this with you because I love it. So one of the fun examples of team sports from the ancient world was not so much, it was about the Romans getting really excited to support their team, and this happened in chariot races. So there were different teams for different parts of the city, the reds, the blacks, the greens, and you would support your team in the chariot race, so you would know who the driver was, and you might even solicit someone to make for you a curse tablet that would curse the horses of the opposing team. You'd go bury it in a grave and you would carve it on lead and you would say, may that horse break their legs so that the greens win instead of the blacks.
Wow.
So there was a sort of team identification and team support even in the ancient world.
Pretty simplistic, but my confirmation theme was you are saved to serve. So the serving becomes a community goal, as it were. I mean, you know, I said before, I know where I'm going, but how do I get, you know, it's not how I get there, but I already know where I'm going, so now I am free to run the race, to do what I need to do to serve others in my community. So it's not an athletic race, but it's still a race.
I think when we bring in that idea of service, that makes me think about the contemporary cases that I'm imagining, because we reward athletes today with endorsements, really high-paying contracts. So when we think about the athlete idea, I think service might fall out the window a little bit. But I'm not sure that that's entirely true, right? Because a lot of athletes engage in philanthropy. A lot of teams and owners engage in philanthropy. So that's an interesting component that was not active in the ancient world, right? The athletes were not serving anyone in particular. They might represent their city, but they were not involved in service in that way. So I want to look at just a couple of contemporary ideas to throw out here. One of the things is what we expect athletes to sacrifice. So sort of going on this punish my body model. You guys have all heard about CTE, right? This chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Study from 2018 by the Concussion Foundation showed that 190 of 202 football players, which is 94%, who played in college or the NFL have been diagnosed with CTE. Among players who played in college but did not play professionally, CTE was diagnosed in 86%. So really high numbers, and that's a really high cost for athletes, especially if we're thinking about college-age students who are meant to be student athletes, right? So for public entertainment, athletes are punishing their bodies in some pretty extreme ways. So I think that's
where it starts with college. It probably starts with junior high.
Absolutely,
or even
right?
Like a little kid.
Third grade in our school.
And it hasn't come up yet, right? But at least in the contemporary world, there is a difference between pay and public visibility for male and female athletes. So they're talking about college football players, they're talking about men, right? And professional football players. So there's a gendered cost here as well.
Yeah, maybe there's another cost too in that, you know, a young athlete, I mean, we know more about the brain and, you know, the reconfiguring and reconstruction that occurs like in the later mid-20s. And they're subjected to this at a point in time where even though they may be saying they're consciously choosing to do this, mm-hmm. I think we as a society have to be saying, we still need to protect those brains a lot longer than we seem to, you know, hold on to having some responsibility.
Right, if you think about
it. Well, they're choosing to do this. But I think we have to hold ourselves a bit more accountable.
Well, it's kind of like a coal miner who's choosing to go into the coal mine. Yeah, what are the options if you don't?
Yeah, no food on the table.
Right.
What are the constraints on people who choose to go into athletics? And some maybe because you love it, right? But if you're not aware of the potential cost, are you making the best informed decision?
And when you're 18, you can't be.
Right, your frontal lobe is not fully formed.
Yeah. I'll tell you, life expectancy, too. I mean, we noticed that some of the college athletes, football players in particular, don't seem to live long. And you get out of the discipline once you're too old to play.
Mm-hmm.
Your body goes to pot.
Yep. I watched a really interesting documentary about professional wrestling, too, where so many people die young and have many, many really terrible medical conditions because their bodies just get so destroyed.
Then there's the ways in which the NCAA's insistence that on just athletes not being paid.
Mm-hmm.
It's to schools trying to encourage people to come there with other kinds of means
mm-hmm.
that also aren't necessarily great for either the athletes or their colleagues around them, in, right? And so we end up with all these cultures of, I mean, frankly, rape culture, right? On
mm-hmm.
a lot of college campuses that's fed by sort of the ways in which we think about athletes being in the middle of those communities.
Right, and the sort of glorification of members mm-hmm. of these teams, yeah.
I mean, we keep talking about their choices and everything, but we're also proudly standing behind the Badgers and buying season tickets for these football games.
Exactly.
We're proudly mm-hmm. waiting for our spot at the Green Bay Packers Stadium for us to sit on the bench. So, I mean, we are also saying, it is okay that you're smashing your brains. I mean, it's not like it's all of their choices. I mean, we are wholeheartedly backing them and hoping that that football team shows up, you know, so...
Mm-hmm.
We are just as guilty as, you know,
to die, so would you.
Yeah, but no, it is the gladiator model,
it is.
Right? It is. There's a very high social cost and individual human cost. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is obviously you guys all know about the Colin Kaepernick case. And so this is really interesting to me because in the ancient world, athletes were supposed to be training their bodies, disciplining their bodies, and also training internal virtue that would serve the state. But people get really, really upset when athletes talk about ethics.
I'm not a football person, so I don't know about this.
Okay, would anyone like to maybe summarize? Colin Kaepernick, if I can give just a very brief summary, is an NFL player, but no longer an NFL player, who decided to protest police brutality by kneeling during the national anthem. So you probably have heard about repercussions of that. Many players and coaches and fans also participated, but many people were up in arms because they thought that kneeling during the national anthem gets complicated because then you're disrespecting our military. And there were many comments that were made, why is this athlete talking about the justice system, stick to what you know, which is how to play football, right? Yeah.
I'm having a hard time with that being disrespectful because in church we kneel or bow to show respect
mm-hmm.
and that people interpret that as disrespectful. I didn't understand that.
I also have read a number of things where it said that when he was developing this idea for how to do a physical sign of protest, the person he spoke with was a military veteran, right, who suggested this posture. So, but there have been repercussions. He no longer has a contract, right? So this is a really interesting case for me about what do we expect of athletes in American society and what do we shut athletes away from because of what we expect and don't expect. So I don't know if there are other...
Would that have been as bad if they had been white?
Almost certainly not, right? No. Yeah.
No, then they would have been using their brains and thinking.
Would it have been as bad if these athletes who began the protest were white? Would the backlash have been as extreme?
No.
No. Right?
No.
Yeah.
You think of the Mexico Olympics where they held
72. Mm-hmm.
And people always get up in arms and say, what are athletes doing expressing this kind of opinion in a setting where we come and expect to see them doing a physical feat, right? So I think when we imagine athletes today, they're professionals, they're being paid to perform for us to watch and enjoy. And we may have lost some of that idea of what the physical discipline means about internal virtues or internal responsibilities.
Right. That's almost like you're saying the prostitution as like the performers or whatever. So they prostitute themselves on the field and they're paid well for it, so they really shouldn't have much to say.
Right, right. We want them for a particular purpose and not for this other purpose.
Yeah. But in the military, you're never allowed to be expressive like this. And I think that a lot of that bad feelings came with, well, you guys are part of a team. You're two guys out of 30 doing this. Uh-huh. You would be sent to the brig if
right.
you were in military.
Right. So this is a really interesting, we still have that association in our culture between athletes and the military. And when we have this idea of a team that you belong to and your corporate responsibility to that team, individual expressions become problematic, right? So can we at all disentangle the idea of athlete and soldier? I'm trying to do that this week because tomorrow we're going to talk about soldiers as a sort of separate metaphor, but they are interwoven in some really interesting ways.
Some entire team stayed in a locker room.
Yes.
And just so this, you know, they wouldn't have to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do as team to support marginalized people, right, in our community or outside of our community? Can a team choose to do that without repercussions? Yeah.
Well, and we, especially with professional sports, we lose that these are businesses, right? This is not the United States military, which is, you know, a branch part of the government. This is a business, and so before Kaepernick, I'm blanking on his name. There was a similar case in baseball in the early 2000s, where the team owners started using "God Bless America" as one of the because numbers were falling in baseball games in the early 2000s. And so as a sort of to capitalize on the moment of patriotism after 9/11, the team owners say, we're going to start doing God Bless America. And there was a Puerto Rican baseball player, whose name I'm blanking on right now, who played for the Toronto Blue Jays. So not an American team.
Yeah.
Who refused to sing God Bless America because of the ways that Puerto Rico was treated under its relationship to us, who was then fired from his position on the Toronto Blue Jays for not singing God Bless America as a right? So you've got this American citizen, but playing for a Canadian team, but we sort of assume that baseball is the national sport, and therefore, right, in all the ways these things, and it was all at the service of getting more people to buy baseball tickets, right?
Yeah. So that's the connection between athletics and local, state, national identity that we carry today that I think was there in the ancient world, but maybe in a very different way. If you're representing your city-state, that's a much smaller sort of complex. And if you're an athlete in America today, and especially if you're going to the Olympics, you are representing the entire country, and that carries some burden with it that it might not otherwise.
Right.
there are also other repercussions. Statistics, state universities or big universities mm-hmm. say that big teams, football, basketball players, are the poorest givers. They, as alumni, they do not give. And the reason for that, as they say, is because we gave our lives to the university when we were there. They made money off of us when we played.
Mm-hmm. And that's that issue of, do we pay student athletes, or can we say they're student athletes, therefore we don't pay them, right? They're not compensated. And there's a big push at many schools for that.
And school systems, I mean, down to the elementary, the money that goes to coaches and athletics versus music or arts or mm-hmm.
Right, so this is another big question about what is our public allocation of resources towards athletics in this country, right?
God help the coach whose team doesn't win.
Yes, right? So that idea of if the, so I watch Friday Night Lights right now, I moved to Texas, so I'm really excited. But the idea of the coach being responsible for what happens with the team suggests to me that we have ideas about who is responsible for success that are not quite the same as individual athletic prowess in the ancient world. So this metaphor that we use with Paul might get more complicated when we read it today, and we're thinking team sports, we're thinking somebody who's got a coach, we're thinking athletes as celebrities who get paid. We are bringing some of that. Yes, boosters, that's great. And what it means to be a fan, and the way in which we identify with the teams that we support, how strongly do we identify with them? So Paul is calling us to be athletes, not to be fans. That's something that we can play with in the metaphor today that might give us some insight into what it means to be a Christian community, right? We are supposed to be on the field, engaged in the contest, not watching it from the sidelines. Right? Or are we supposed to be fans cheering on the athlete who is competing when we see someone in our community pushing, doing really well? Can we support them as a fan, right? We bring all kinds of things to this metaphor that might enrich it for us in ways that make it more useful or beneficial for thinking about community. So I just wanted to end with a final passage from Philippians. So this is right after the Philippians hymn and then jumping ahead into chapter 3. It is by your holding fast to the word of life that I can boast on the day of Christ that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. So Paul is an athlete who represents the entire community. Or to put that slightly differently, Paul's athletic reward comes from the actions of the community that he founded and fostered. Not that I have already obtained this or have already reached the goal, but I press on to make it my own, because Christ Jesus has made me his own. Beloved, I do not consider that I have made it my own, but this one thing I do. Forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the heavenly call of God in Christ Jesus. So now the prize is not the crown, right? The prize is to receive the call. So every time Paul uses this metaphor, he's doing something a little bit different with it. So how does this strike you in light of the conversation that we've had? If we're thinking about how this metaphor is useful for us in community and how it might not work, or it might block off certain ideas of community that we want to have.
Well, in 16, he becomes the coach.
Yes. Yes, he does. And they had some coaches in the ancient world, right? You would have a trainer who was responsible. Mm-hmm. But he's not necessarily talking about being the trainer. He's talking about running himself. So for us, this carries a connotation of coach that it might not have for his first readers.
Yeah, and yet for today, it would be, I mean, it sounds like the coach who, like, you guys get on the field and play, mm-hmm. because that's how I am going to earn my fame.
Yes.
And so it's a reward to me.
Okay, so here's an interesting dynamic. If Paul, as a community leader, says, you are somehow reflecting, or your actions reflect on me, you are the team, get out on the field and play.
Because it's all about me.
Right, so what does that mean? What does that mean for of community life. That's really interesting.
That's right there.
Yeah. There are, how do you feel about that? If you are the athlete and Paul is the coach.
There are a lot of I's in there that Paul says.
Yeah.
Yes, I this, I that, I consider, I have, I do, I press on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a cost to not participating that even though you're not the one that's going to win and get the prize, there's a part of the pressing on which says if you're not pressing on, then there's a cost to that. We're much more given to division left to ourselves than we are to unity. Mm-hmm. And if you're not participating in the race, even if you don't win, you're still helping the others around.
Yes, right. There, here is the way that this works for belonging, is that your actions affect other people on the team, right?
Right.
And so you have a responsibility to continue straining forward, to press on towards the goal, so that Paul can boast on the day of Christ, which is this, the parousia when Christ returns. Yeah.
Maybe you could explain a little bit more about the early churches in Philippi and Corinth. And it almost feels like Paul's trying to herd cats, you know, that they're really at the point where, you know, we have to press on because somebody's wandering, or that you may be three quarters of the way through the race but feel fatigued and you want to drop out. And so, you know, there's that sense that there is that trying to keep things together.
And he was competing against other people that were.
And all of these letters are written after Paul has gone to the community and sort of planted the seed, right? He's proclaimed the gospel kerygma, the pronouncement about Jesus being the Christ, about the life, death, and resurrection. And then he's left and is in communication. So these letters are being sent back after he gets reports about what's going on in the community. So usually he's responding to some kind of report that something has gone wrong, right? Or here's the thing that's going really well over here. And so he is in a position where he's trying to reinforce the message that he gave. And this athletic metaphor does a lot to encourage people to stick with it, right? I think this one is very effective for that. Whereas the idea of children that we talked about yesterday, not so useful for the encouragement or perseverance, but it does other things, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking about our hike yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and how 90%, we went up to Copper Basin yesterday.
It was very hard. I hit a wall.
Right, yeah. And the wall, when we're talking about how the wall had to do with not knowing how much farther it was,
mm-hmm.
and especially if this isn't a community that's wondering when the parousia is happening, like, I thought we'd be there by now.
And the only way to continue on the hike is to forget what lies behind. Forget it. I've already hiked up this thing that's straight vertical for 2 hours, but I'm going to strain forward to what lies ahead. Right? So this is really the endurance. So he's picking up on that endurance piece of the athleticism, maybe more than the discipline helps you develop virtue. Even though that's there.
I think of how we really need to tool ourselves more so that we're less the bystander. And I live in Minneapolis, and last fall, Minneapolis Synod is focusing, we're trying to incorporate more organizing focus, and so I went to a week-long overnight organizing training that the juniors were working on outside of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a powerful experience and really helped me. It's helping me work through the fear of being active and activist.
Sure.
And so I think, which is a lesson for all of us, is that the fear really holds us up. And what can we do to tool ourselves so we're less the bystander? There's so many things that are going on around us. Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate that as the sort of the final word for today, right? How do we get out on the field and be the athletes in our community? So thank you for your thoughts today. Tomorrow we will be talking about soldiers. So please come back, and I hope we'll have another productive conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.